Get 3 months of The Spectator for just £3. Go to spectator.co.uk/trial.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Oscar Edmondson and I'm joined today by Katie Balls and Isabel Hardman. So 3 weeks in for the new government and we've had our first Labour rebellion. In a vote last night on the SNP amendment to axe the two child benefit cap, seven Labour MPs revolted and have subsequently lost the Labour whip. Katie, who are the seven and how has Starmer's ruthlessness gone down in Westminster?
So I think the first thing to note is that the seven are, in a way, the usual suspects. Obviously, this is a new parliament and you could argue, therefore, it's a new awkward squad. But I think the new awkward squad looks a lot like the old awkward squad. Effectively, if we go through them, you know, you had Zara Sultana, who's very much known to be one of the more Corbynite tendency MPs. You've got Richard Bergen, who served in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet. You have Rebecca Long-Bailey, who, of course, was seen as the potential Corbyn successor in that leadership contest when Keir Starmer won. And then you have John McDonnell and a couple of others. So in terms of names, I think if you tried to guess who were the most likely rebels, you would get most of those. Of course, it's notable that Kim Johnson, who was actually pushing for this, did not decide to go against. You also have some notable absences in the sense that Rosie Duffield was not there, had COVID. Dan Abbott was away on other business. So potentially it could have been a bit higher. But as Isabel wrote for the Evening Blend, I think it, you know, initially, you had last week, for example, you know, the announcement of the Child Poverty Task Force, which was clearly designed, yes, to achieve its goal, but the timing of which was designed to send a signal to Labour MPs anxious about the plan to keep the two-child benefit cap in place, that thinking was going on this, and it's a clear signal that they are likely to scrap it potentially in the autumn. And then yesterday, I think as they tried to get the rebellion down, you soon heard Labour MPs ultimately saying they felt they're being threatened and they would have the whip removed. Around the time of voting, I was at the Speaker's reception and lots of journalists saying, you know, is he really going to remove the whip? I think there was a sense of surprise they would go that far. In the end, they removed the whip for 6 months and then it will be reviewed. I think it's an interesting question. When you look at that list, I don't think Keir Starmer's inner circle are going to be crying themselves to sleep at night that some of those MPs are currently not Labour MPs. Some of those are the ones I think that you know, if they had misbehaved ahead of the election, the party had been quite quick to move against and get them out. But there is a question as to, is it an overreaction? Clearly, what has happened is something I wrote about in the magazine last week, speaking to a senior Labour figure, was there was a sense that the first rebellion had to be dealt with carefully and to send a strong signal, because it wasn't so much that this amendment had any chance of passing, but how Keir Starmer responds to backbench pressure is clearly going to be a theme for the, you know, entire parliament. And therefore, I think there's a view that in the first year or two, you cannot do anything that can look like a symbolic win to the left of the party for what it would send. And that's perhaps why you have what I think is, most would agree, no matter where you sit, quite an extreme reaction to a pretty light rebellion. What would have happened if it was 60 Labour MPs who had voted for this amendment? I think, you know, seven MPs and ones that you don't particularly want to give jobs to, fine, that's one thing. I think the question is, do you end up in a situation now where, yes, newbie MPs who are anxious, they've seen how you're meant to behave in this party, but could there be an issue later down the line, which is a bigger rebellion? And then it's a much more serious thing to say, oh, we're going to remove the whip, you know, double figures plus.
Mm. Isabel, what do you make of that? Has he set a bit of a dangerous precedent here?
I mean, they've definitely adopted the strategy that a lot of teachers at the start of secondary school adopt, where they just scream at you to scare the bejesus out of you and try and get some discipline. And maybe in later years, they start to actually, you know, treat students with sort of a little bit more respect and humour. And you can totally understand why they've done that, because if you look back to 97, when Tony Blair came in with a big majority and still a rump of hard left, left-wing MPs, there was a very indulgent strategy from the whips towards those MPs, which was basically, look, we've got a big majority, we'll just let Jeremy Corbyn et al. Vote as they please. You know, they would ring up very politely and say, oh, just checking you're voting against us tonight. And these guys became a sort of perma-rump of rebels, perma-rebels. And I think Starmer's lot draw a direct line from that sort of indulgence to the left then flourishing in opposition and Corbyn becoming leader, because they were never really dealt with. And the whole strategy of Morgan McSweeney and Starmer has been to deal with these guys one way or t'other. The question is whether this is going to... I mean, I certainly think that this benefits both sides. You know, you've got Starmer dealing with the hard left. You've got the hard left being martyrs on something, which they will benefit from. They can milk. And actually, they can also get a great deal of applause from their side when, as we know he will, Starmer reverses the policy on the cap and scraps it, because he and Rachel Reeves have been clear they don't like the cap, they just can't afford to scrap it at the moment. And so the standoff last night was not on a big point of principle or these guys rebelling against Starmer's vision for the country. It was rebelling over trusting Starmer's timescale. Now, that's obviously not how they'll sell it to their supporters, not how the SNP are selling it, but that is what it was about. And so when he does reverse this policy and say, oh, we found £3 billion, we can now afford to drop this. By the way, the public think we should keep it. I think it's 67% of voters think that the cap should remain, but it's an emotional issue for lots of Labour MPs who did vote with the government last night. Then the hard left can say, oh, we were right all along, and look, we had to suffer to get this to happen. Now, that's not what happened, but you can see these alternative narratives arising. So I think it's probably helped both sides to a certain extent. And I just wonder, you know, it is a step up. It's a nuclear option, or was previously a nuclear option when it came to whipping. Even on big issues previously, rebels in both parties would be punished in more administrative ways. So they'd be put on a series of 8:15 a.m. delegated legislation committees. Now, 8:15 a.m. is basically the middle of the night in parliamentary terms, because people don't tend to turn up until about 11 in Westminster, and then they go late. So that's one way of punishing them. It's also saying, well, we're not going to slip you, we're not going to let you go on an overseas trip. So suddenly your fascinating select committee trip to the south coast of France in the summer, for instance, you can't go on. So that was the kind of normal way of dealing with somebody who'd rebelled. And this was a nuclear option. Remember when Boris Johnson stripped the whip of a load of Tory anti-Brexit rebels back in 2019? I mean, it sent shockwaves through Westminster. So this is a big shift. And does it mean you have to do this all the time now? Is this just the equivalent of, you know, bawling out the naughty kid on the first day of school and then going to a more reasonable disciplinary regime? Or are you just going to be suspending a hell of a lot of people over the next few months? I don't know, but I'm not sure this is straightforward, because it's not a straightforward issue.
I think it would be unsustainable to have this level of discipline on. Now, it might be because it is a King's speech, but you know, if it came across various amendments and spread out, you know, it is an unsustainable thing to do. I can see them having quite tight control because of the size of the majority. Yeah. But we have seen, you know, bad will does get stored up. Yeah. And I think what's interesting is the seven MPs who have lost the whip. Again, I don't think there's too much crying and cornflakes amongst some, but across the Labour Party, there are MPs who question the treatment of them, you know, if you take away the personalities.
Yeah. But do you think this is just an occupational hazard of having such a big majority? I think I remember a piece that you wrote in the run-up to the election about how in this supermajority scenario, Labour effectively becomes government and opposition. Is that what we're seeing?
I think it is, which is why obviously they have to be particularly careful about how you deal with your first rebellion, because you look at the numbers and also you look at the fact the Tories aren't even going to have a leader of opposition until November. Clearly more opposition and more relevant opposition is probably coming from within the Labour Party. Now, the majority is so big, you can argue, oh, he's going to be able to do whatever he wants. But lots of people said that with Boris Johnson. So there's definitely an element of that. And I think this is clearly an effort to say no. When John McDonnell has gone around saying, guys, this amendment, actually we're helping Keir Starmer because we're giving him the cover to move, which was the message from coming some of these rebels to new MPs. New MPs bringing this up in the parliamentary Labour Party meetings and talking about how they felt they'd been put in an impossible situation. I think this is an attempt to, you know, say, actually, no, this is how we're going to behave. But clearly, as Isabel says, there's a question of how you sustain that, because there's going to be, you know, bigger skirmishes coming up the track.
And Isabel, just finally, the other news is that we've had the first person to announce their candidacy for leader of the Conservative Party in James Cleverly. Surely no surprises there.
No, and he said that yesterday that there was a reasonable chance that he was going to stand, which I think is exactly the phrase that Mel Stride has also used. So I've been watching him in the Commons over the past couple of days because he had to respond to a statement by Yvette Cooper on Monday, and then yesterday he and Cooper were sparring in the Home Affairs debate section on the King's Speech. And it's really interesting the stance that Cleverly is taking, which is basically to be very, very combative, to accuse Yvette Cooper of disrespecting African countries, to sort of lay down markers about illegal immigration. And also, and this is something that Rishi Sunak is trying to do rather more plaintively, and I suspect we'll hear some of this again at PMQs, to try to defend the record of the Conservatives. So we've spent most of this podcast talking about amendments to the King's Speech. Now, none of the ones that were of interest came from the official opposition. There was an amendment from the official opposition, which was this really plaintive, needy one, calling on the House to recognise that the economy was growing when this government took over, and basically trying to combat the narrative that every Labour minister is now pushing of the disaster of the last 14 years, as they call it, and things being much worse than we expected when we got into our department, and sort of melodramatic horror. And that's where the sort of Sunak Cleverly line of thinking is that they have to push back against this Labour narrative. And Cleverly is, he's a much more combative politician than Sunak ever was. And I think when Sunak has tried to be combative, he's often just looked like he's had too much coffee, whereas Cleverly really enjoys it. And I think is often quite, quite good at it. So that'll be his style of leadership. But there's this whole debate within the party about where the party needs to go and where it needs to swing, and I don't think that's a question he's necessarily answered yet.
I think there's interesting polling of the general public on the Tory candidates from a month or so ago, which had James Cleverly out in front. But of course, what matters most right now in terms of electorates is MPs and then the membership, and he is not ahead with the membership. I do think that his pitch of being a unifier does appeal to some in the party, and probably his main competition when it comes to his MP nominations in terms of the shape of the party is going to be Tom Tugendhat. Mm. I don't think James Cleverly is particularly left-wing, but he also is someone who doesn't support leaving the ECHR, and that is going to be a dividing line in this contest. So I think he is probably dipping in the pool of One Nation MPs, some centrists, some former ministers, perhaps some Cameroons, and then that means you're going up against figures like Tugendhat. And the battle probably for the right of the party and those MP nominations is going to be much more Robert Jenrick, potentially Kemi Badenoch. Kemi Badenoch will also try and get some centre MPs. But therefore, I would be very surprised if both Tom Tugendhat and James Cleverly win the final two, and potentially a struggle for them both to get in the final four.
Well, thank you, Katie. Thank you, Isabel. And thank you very much for listening. And if you do enjoy the podcast and you listen on Apple Podcasts, please give us a follow. But if you're on Spotify, if you could leave us a rate and review, that would be much appreciated.